This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, crossing the border, Mexican caravanistas journey across the U.S. to deliver their message against militarizing the drug abuse. And then the people's documentarian and leading exponent against police and prison abuse, currently facing his own felony charges, Jazz Hayden joins us.
And now, Mexican exhibits in the first binational caravan of more than 115, mostly victims of the drug war, arrived in New York City on their month-long journey across the U.S. They called attention to organized crime, money laundering by greedy financial institutions who say they are equally responsible, the activists, for the bloodshed caused by the drug merchants and corrupt Mexican government officials serving them, and supported as well by the U.S. government.
Memorializing the move by more than 60,000 who have died, including the son of poet Javier Cecilia, a caravan organizer on both sides of the border, the message is to stop militarizing and treat drug abuse as a public health problem, not a war. Now we speak with the caravanistas.
We're in City Hall Park with a woman. She has crossed the border from Mexico and is one of the caravanistas who's been crossing the country to deliver an important message, and we want to find out what that message is.
We are here in the United States on a quest for peace, to show the faces of our dead loved ones. I lost my son to the so-called war on drugs. We are a movement of victims. We are hoping to touch the heart of the American people, to raise some awareness about the situation we are going through. We are living in a state of emergency, state of war. We believe that the United States shares responsibility for this situation. The war on drugs was declared over 40 years ago by President Nixon, and it's been implemented today by President Barack Obama and President Calderon in Mexico. Our intention here is to start a debate on alternatives to drug prohibition, also to do something about the weapons that are crossing the border from United States to Mexico. The smuggling of assault weapons is huge, considering the enormous business that it represents, as well as drugs do. We also have a huge wound, the trafficking of people in my country. We have over 20,000 missing people, so it's an effort that has to come from the people. We are here in a citizen diplomacy quest. We want to talk to the people. We want to get to a consensus on what's the path to follow for peace. We have to change the way we see the world and do something to make it a better place for our children, for our grandchildren.
Could you expand a bit on the magnitude of the devastating problem in Mexico with the drug wars?
National Institute of Statistics, Geography and Information Technology just showed us the data that we have over 95,000 assassinations in the past 5 years. Although nobody agrees. Some people talk about 60,000, some people talk of over 150,000 dead people, so we don't really know how many dead people are. But they are not ciphers. My son has a name, he has a face, he has a family, he has a story. So regardless of how many dead people, the issue is in Mexico, crimes are not being investigated. We have a shameful 97% impunity. It's inhuman. It has to do with organized crime. I mean, what does organized crime mean? Who are they organized with? They're organized with corrupt authorities. It's a huge problem. There are states in Mexico where people just don't dare visit. Tamaulipas, where last year they found a mass grave with over 75 migrants. Nobody knows who they are, where they came from. There's no documents. Then we have the situation of extreme poverty in Mexico. We have over 50,000 extremely poor people living with under $2 a day. It's a problem of structural violence. It's not only the narco cartels. It's much deeper and much older. So we are appealing to the American people, to American authorities, to put this issue on the debate table. I mean, it must be in the agenda of politicians, and nobody seems to even notice us. They don't care. They don't care. We are in war. We have lost our children. There's children here looking for their parents. There's Maria Herrera. She's looking for four of her children. They're missing. They've been abducted by narcos. Nobody cares. President Calderon has lied to us. He has betrayed us. We came up with an incredible law for victims with the support of the universities and law firms, and President Calderon vetoed it, and he's leaving now. He doesn't care. So we are appealing on President Barack Obama.
You have a picture that you're holding of a very handsome young man. It says, no more drug war.
That's right.
That is your son, I assume. Tell us about his story.
This is the picture of my son, Joaquin Garcia Jurado Carmona. He was born in Cancun, 1989. He was a very charming young man who decided to study architecture in Mexico City. We were all very proud of him. He moved to Mexico City in 2008, where he was doing a great job at college. And a couple of days before he started his third year in college, he was brutally assassinated with absolute impunity inside his apartment. There is no investigation. There is no investigation in 97% of the crimes in my country. So we are here asking for justice, but further than justice, we want to raise awareness because this is an epidemic. One morning someone calls you and tells you your son has been assassinated. We don't want that to happen to more people. It spread it far too much, so you're not immune to this.
What's your experience crossing the U.S. to deliver this painful, powerful message?
On one side, the organization of the Caravan for Peace has been from American organizations, NGOs. In that sense, we have had a lot of support, which has been incredible. It has been very well organized, a lot of people. On the other side, the people in the streets, they don't know what's going on. They wonder, what are you talking about? It's not surprising because we know that people are quite deceived by the media. But then when we tell them what it is about, people are really solidarious with us. And then I believe it was Chicago, and this church, the priest actually asked for our forgiveness. That is something that really hit me because I accepted that the apology, because that's what American people should do.
I have to pause for a moment as I hear your story, but I must say that your strength and your conviction and your effort to educate the American public to build solidarity with families such as yourself in Mexico, we thank you for. And we have been speaking with Teresa Carmona. Thank you. We're here with Laura Carlson, who we've spoken to by phone in Mexico for years, and it's a delight to see her in person. Laura, help contextualize the message of the Caravanistas, whom you've traveled with from Mexico now to City Hall Park.
The message of End the Drug War has crossed the border because of the United States' long role in promoting the drug war. It really has its origins in the free trade agreement that was then expanded into a security agreement with Mexico, in which the United States sought to include Mexico within its security perimeter. When the drug war was launched by Felipe Calderon in the year 2006, the entire model was already in place. Instead of treating drug abuse and even drug trafficking and drug prohibition in the United States in a different way, there would be a militarized response in which the United States, hypocritically saying it would share responsibility, actually meant that it would send guns and military equipment and training to Mexico to ostensibly try to block the flow of drugs at the border and keep them from arriving into the U.S. market. That particular model and that goal has never worked anywhere it's ever been tried. So people on this caravan have begun to question deeper and deeper whether or not that really is the goal. What we've seen is that there are a lot of people who are benefiting from this drug war, especially the defense companies that are getting the contracts from the United States, Mexican very small political elite that's leaning on the army to maintain control over the population, while this huge part of the population is seeing the bloodshed and the now more than 60,000 people who have been killed as a result of this model.
So what should be the policy response from the U.S. side? What is the caravan calling for? What are you calling for?
The caravan's calling for five different things. One is to review drug policy, consider alternatives to prohibition, which hasn't worked, including regulation of certain drugs. In this way, what you do is automatically take this lucrative, that's estimated at $38 billion market, out of the hands of organized crime if there's legal sourcing and regulation by the state, instead of this situation where it's entirely criminalized, which means it's entirely out of control. Another is to review immigration laws. We've seen a parallel between militarization under counter-narcotics effort and militarization of the border that's directly affected immigrants and border residents. Another one is to immediately end all security aid, and that's under the Merida Initiative and also through the Department of Defense. That security aid is going to security forces, both police and army, that are demonstrably corrupt in Mexico. If you talk to these victims, you'll find that in many cases, the primary suspect of the disappearance or assassination of their loved one is not organized crime, but the state itself. Reorient that aid money to peaceful building up of society that makes it better able to resist the infiltration of organized crime. There are very concrete alternatives, but the door has been closed to all alternatives as long as this drug war model has been the policy of both governments.
One of the things that I'm also interested in, you've drawn attention to HSBC and Citibank. Can you talk about what role they play in this?
Money laundering is another one of the main points. These drug cartels function on those $38 billion of earnings. That's how they buy their arms. That's how they buy off politicians. That's how they recruit Mexico's young people into their ranks. And if that money is cut off, the money that is currently flowing through the legitimate financial system with banks like HSBC, then you've made a considerable blow against organized crime. In this case, there's a huge scandal right now with HSBC. They bought a bank in Mexico, so they have significant interests in Mexico, and their affiliates in Mexico were transferring. In 2 years, they transferred like $7 billion in cash from Mexico to the United States, which is fairly clearly a laundering operation. They've also set up accounts in the Cayman Islands for Mexico clients, pretty much no questions asked. There were practices that very clearly fall within the realm of suspicious, to say the least, that were neither investigated nor controlled. They're being looked at very carefully now. A Senate committee has come out with a report. It's not likely that they'll get off scot-free, but we're here to say this is not a victimless crime. This is not a nonviolent crime. This white-collar crime, money laundering itself, is actually responsible for many of the victims here.
And within Mexico itself, there were elections recently. There's a new government coming in December. Calderón is out. Nieto will be in. What is the debate like within Mexico? Are some of these points resonating there?
Unfortunately, there hasn't been nearly enough of debate. Peña Nieto has come out and said he will continue the drug war as is, and he will continue the military and security cooperation with the U.S. government. There's also been fears within the U.S. government that Peña Nieto would go back to what's commonly considered his party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party model of making agreements with drug cartels. He's promised formally the United States government that he will continue the drug war. And in any case, because of the violence and the fragmentation of the drug cartels that's happened as a result of these selective hits over the past 5 years, those demons can't really be put it back into the box even if you tried. There's so much chaos in terms of the turf wars between drug cartels for different trafficking routes and production areas that ability to create central agreements has probably been lost anyway.
Laura, tell us who the caravanistas are and how this caravan sojourning across the U.S.
has come together.
In March, a year ago, when Javier Cecilia's son was brutally murdered.
And Javier Cecilia is a major poet in Mexico.
He is a well-known writer, and his response in the middle of his grief was to come out and blame the government, at least in part, for this crime, because it's in the context of the instability as a result of the drug war that the violence has gone way up in the last couple of years, and young people like Juan Francisco have been killed. He started a march first from Cuernavaca, where they live, because he had to speak out to find justice for his son's murder and actually to end the drug war. That was the beginning of a movement that already had roots within Mexican society. And then there were two caravans to the north and the south that began to collect victims and victims' families, especially mostly women, who were trying to seek justice. Where is my disappeared son or husband or daughter, in the case especially of Ciudad Juarez, who will be held responsible for these murders? They began, out of their frustration, to join the movement. So the other pillar of the movement, besides an end to the drug war, is this demand to bring attention to the fact that the Mexican justice system is completely dysfunctional, as well as being highly corrupt. When you have a combination of militarization, a military approach to a drug war or to organized crime, and a justice system that doesn't function, you essentially have utter chaos.
Laura, the poverty of Mexico, the issue of jobs, the issues of globalization, and our own complaints here from immigrant communities about the failure for a comprehensive immigration reform policy. How does that tie into the issues of this caravan as well?
First of all, so many of the migrants here are really economic refugees. And now increasingly we're seeing refugees of the violence as well here in the United States. Both those problems, the violence and the economic crisis in Mexico, are largely responsibility of the United States. First of all, because the free trade agreement that displaced small farmers and small business people because of unfair terms of competition with transnational corporations. And then later, of course, the violence has been promoted under the Merida Initiative and others. So those people are also feeling it doubly, because with the criminalization practically of the entire country of Mexico, now seen as almost a narco state, which is entirely false, but is a very common interpretation that's being put out by the media here, there's also this increased criminalization of migrants and of the border itself, and that's putting their lives at greater risk and making them face these kinds of hate laws in many states throughout the United States now.
So we are with Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of
the Center for International Policy,
which does great work. Go to their website
at www.cipamericas.org.
And now, after the Caravanistas, we move to Jazz Hayden, a founding member of the Riverside Church's Ministries Campaign to End the New Jim Crow. It's dedicated to combating mass incarceration and building caring communities. For the past 4 years, Jazz has been videotaping police officers as they perform illegal stop and frisks in Harlem as part of his coverage of the Harlem community as a citizen journalist. Jazz, most critically, since we don't have nearly enough time to discuss all the important issues, I want to look at your case. Tell us what you face, what is happening in terms of the grand jury.
Well, as a result of my community service, I ended up in this position, and my community service took the form of covering everything that goes on in Harlem. And one of the chief issues that I covered in Harlem was police-community relationships. So as a result of my coverage of police-community relationships over the last 4 years, I've accumulated a huge body of work documenting the abuse of police power, especially in Harlem, because this is where I confine the majority of my activity. And as a result of that, with every action, there's always a reaction. There was a pushback on December 2nd of last year. And I was pulled over and stopped on a bogus charge of having a brake light out in the back. I drive a Jeep, which has brake lights on both sides, and because it's a Jeep and it's high off the ground in a normal vehicle, it has a brake light right in the middle, in the top. Even if that light was out, which it wasn't, the two brake lights on the side worked. Well, I was pulled over by NYPD plainclothes officers and uniformed officers. But the plainclothes officers were the same officers that I had witnessed abusing some other individuals in July of last year. And I filmed them, and during the process of filming them, we got into some back-and-forth dialogue about what Malcolm X called house Negroes and field Negroes and their role in abusing what they were doing at the time. You know, I'm out there trying to cover the NYPD, providing what they say they provide on the side of their car, courtesy, professionalism, and respect, you know. But that's not what they provide. You know, for the most part in Harlem, they provide bullying, abuse, and false charges, specifically on Harlem youth and generally on anybody that they decide they want to do it to. You know? So anyhow, this back and forth took place, and a couple months later, on December 2nd, this same crew pulled me over on Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard and 132nd Street. You know, the flashing lights, they pulled me over. Hey, we know you. And proceeded to go through their routine. You know, let me get your license and registration. Yeah, for what? You know, just give us your license and registration. I say, okay. Matter of fact, step out of the car. So I step out of the car and I tell them point blank, they do not have my consent to search the car or search me. If they want to pat me down for their safety, they can do that. But don't stick your hands in my pocket. They told me to go to the back of the car, and as soon as I got to the back of the car, they jumped in the car and went to search him. You know. A few minutes later, they come out with a pocket knife that you can buy in any 99-cent store, any hardware store in the country, and they come out holding it like it was a weapon of mass destruction and that they had discovered the missing link and a commemorative baseball bat, you know, that might be anywhere from 12 to 15 inches long. They sell it in any sports stadium in the country. And then they booked me. You know, they handcuffed me, put me in the car, took my Jeep, and drove me to the 32nd precinct. And when I got there, of course, I was stressed to the end, so my blood pressure had risen. And they asked me, was anything wrong? I told them, yeah, I had high blood pressure. They called the ambulance, took me to Harlem Hospital, and sat me over there for a couple of hours until my blood pressure came down. They never medicated me or anything.
Jazz, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Because I want to make sure we get to the critical points, given a very limited amount of time. There's a call-in. I want you to quickly tell people about that to make sure that the charges are dropped. And in addition to that, I want to find out about the press conference. So what are people supposed to do to make sure that the charges are dropped?
Okay, great, great. We can get right to the action piece. We're asking everyone to call Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance's office and ask for Attorney William Darrow. The telephone number is 212-335-9192. 212-335-9192. And
the message is, tell Darrow to drop the charges against Jazz Hayden. And what are we supposed to do also in terms of the grand jury, Jazz?
We want everyone, as many people, to turn out as possible at 100 Center Street. And we'll be there at 8:30 in the morning. And we want everyone to turn out to demonstrate in front of the courthouse down there. Of course, we won't be able to go into the grand jury, but this is more to let the public know and let the people, that establishment and that fort down there, to know that we are concerned. And, if they can do it to me, they can do it to anyone, you know.
Jazz is a grandfather. Jazz is a community activist, unflinching, devoted to defending the people of Harlem and New York from the racist NYPD. PD. He has devoted considerable time to stopping stop and frisk policies, and certainly the policies that lead to mass incarceration. But most critically, we have to make sure Jazz, who is facing a possible 14 years in prison, there is no option. We must have the charges dropped. We must keep Jazz free.
These are trumped up charges. Jazz is an incredible political activist, and that's the reason he is being persecuted by the NYPD. Support him.
Brother Jazz, thank you for being a stimulant to all of us in the struggle against police abuse of power and the state of mass incarceration in this country.
We're all with you, Jazz.
All right. Thank you, Mimi and Miss Nash, man. It's people like you, you know, that make it... that make this struggle, you know, worthwhile. You know, they offered me community service at one point, and I wouldn't take it because I'm tired, man. I'm tired of submitting and,
Well, we're not going to let that happen, we hear you, and it's actually people like you. So we're going to be back to you early and often.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, my brother.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.